Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Kimak Candy.
Vaccine.
Well, I'll just have to place that in post-production. We'll just have to forget that, and we'll jump right into the introduction.
I was afraid you were going to say you were going to have to sing it.
Well, it is instrumental. I could try it.
Becky, where are you? There's a reason you're not supposed to be late.
You still want to do the introduction, right? You didn't change your mind.
Just get you to stop singing, I'll do it, sure. Hello, welcome to episode 125. My name is K-Man Candy, and I am joined by the Mian Team. Who gets to be
team,
introduced
the
first
the Mian Team.
Yeah, what did I say? I thought I said the Mian Team.
Hey, there's no James Bond, it's Team, the Mian Team.
I thought I said that.
Thank you.
And Dan, Q.
If computer systems can learn the meaning of words by interacting with their environment, so should people.
And Vexing is our guest today.
Well, hello there.
And we hope to be joined by Makalua shortly.
Kelly is filling in again for an absent Lisa. We had Cardamandua last week, and that's to help keep us on track and not be too silly.
Exactly.
A few weeks ago, Civilization World launched into a public beta out of the closed alpha.
Christoph Hartmann, president of 2K Studios, was asked about why they're turning XCOM into a first-person shooter instead of a tactical strategy game. And they bought the intellectual property through Atari or something. He said about it that strategy games are just not contemporary. He went on to posit something about Ray Charles, that he would be imitating Kanye West if he were still around, which seems ridiculous to me. So they are trying to, I guess, make XCOM into a game for millions of 13-year-old teenagers.
Oh, man. I'm, like, cringing externally, internally, and somewhere else entirely. This is painful.
My gosh, where do we even begin? In the thread on a Flash of Steel here, Flash of Steel is a strategy blog by Troy Goodfellow, who's been a guest a couple of times on the show, and in the comments on this in this thread, there were some really good ones. I think King Daddy had a really good introduction and a good summary when talking about Christoph Hartmann, the president of 2K Studios, saying it's quite an achievement to say profoundly stupid things on several fronts simultaneously.
That pretty much sums it up right there. I mean, right when one of their franchises is starting to compete with a finally and hopefully good turn-based strategy release, and Heroes of Might and Magic 6 coming up, we'll see about that, though. But if it is good, then Civ's going to have its first real competition in a long time. You're going to see this. Oh, no. And come on, there are so many first-person shooters in the market today that it's a little bit flooded. And when they're doing something like this business model-wise, you know, what are they going to do that makes XCOM compete with the Call of Duty, with the Halos, with the Gears of War, with all the shooters out there? XCOM is going to need something that would differentiate it from all that and put it ahead. And if the only thing that differentiates it is that it used to be a good turn-based strategy, that's not going to win out. Not at all.
And if that's indeed the market that they're going for, like you said, the market is already flooded with first-person shooters, so perhaps you think, okay, we're going to get some attention by the name. But if people aren't aware of the name and the history and they can understand that, then you're probably not going to get them to go, hey, I should look at this because it's got the XCOM name and look a little bit more into it. So at the same time, you're trying to tap into that. And yeah, indeed, maybe we 90s gamers, we're not the majority anymore. Of course, he's also assuming that nobody from the 90s, or I shouldn't say nobody from the 90s, but people from the 90s don't prefer first-person shooters, and people from today prefer first-person shooters. So even if we accept that as the case, you're going to get lost in that sea of all the other first-person titles. And then for people from our generation who are interested in it, let's say that, okay, we're going to try it, even though it is a first-person shooter, it's got the XCOM name on it, let's try it. But when you go out and you call us, you're essentially saying that we are has-beens, that we're not contemporary, and that we also need to move on. Wow. I realize it's just one person saying this, and I really think it's hurting the people who are trying to bring back XCOM, even if it isn't in the form that we wanted. I really don't see anything positive that came out of these comments. I mean, the Ray Charles comment was just, okay, you know, you already have your foot in your mouth, now you want it to go down your throat too? I mean, honestly, what are you doing?
It doesn't really make any business sense to me either. It's not like the nostalgia factor is going to really draw more fans to their title. Either they're going to make a good first-person shooter, regardless of the name, or they're not going to, and I don't predict too many people are going to be buying the game just because it's called XCOM.
No, especially since it isn't what made XCOM a good game in the first place.
It's not at all. It's just going to have, like, whatever slightly nostalgic references, but that won't do anything for me personally.
Imagine's right in the chat that, yes, I mean, it is one person, but it is president of 2K Studios, so it's not even one of those situations where you have someone is like an underling, and then the person above can come and say, actually, what that person meant to say was, really, I mean, I guess somebody lower down could say that at the peril of their own career, or at least with, you know, their continued employment with the company. I like Anders' comment on the Flash of Steel blog. I was furious when I first saw the first-person shooter trailer, but then I realized it was titled XCOM and not X-COM. Sure, it's a subtle difference, but I'll take it. Well, that's looking at the... Good for you, finding the positive.
Yes, I'm very impressed with this. This guy's glass half full capability.
But just to bring one point out a little further from Josh, saying it's a shame to see industry moguls foster a disconnect between the mainstream audience and enthusiasts for the medium. After all, both groups enjoy accessibility, but it should not jeopardize the quality of the core elements of the game. And as Manjin was also pointing in the thread, we 90s gamers probably have access to a little bit more money than those from the 2000s. That's not to say that there aren't exceptions. I think it can appeal to both gamers. I mean, some people suggested, how come you can't release XCOM first-person shooter and then also do XCOM, you know, in more in the strategy style that we're familiar with, that it wouldn't necessarily, dilute the brand if they're, you know, under two different genres. I don't know if the fact that you dropped the hyphen in XCOM is enough just as kind of a visual glance to distinguish. Some people actually harp on, well, does XCOM really have, you know, is it really a franchise? Is there really that much history to it? Because nothing's been done with it for more than a decade. And if you only want to appeal to one market, okay, you want to appeal to today's generation, you think that's where the money's going to be. I realize this is a business. That's all well and good. Let's assume for the moment that you make it through the flood, that you ride that wave, and God, I'm butchering this analogy, but I'm just going to go with it anyway, that you make money. So, okay, you've chosen that group, but there's no need to then make comments to the group that you didn't choose and say, by the way, your thinking is out of date, you should move on. Can you not tell me what type of games I like to play? You want to appeal to that group, you're not going to appeal to me, fine, but then don't come around and say that my choice in gaming is wrong. That does not make good business sense, as I think we were also saying. Wow.
It's also sad that the president of the releasers of Civ 5 are saying it's not contemporary. It's kind of scary in that, what are they going to continue to do with the Civilization franchise?
Sell it.
Yeah, who wants the Civ license? Oh, wait.
Well, they'll just release it on the phone and Facebook, but maybe my glasses half empty with that comment. I don't know.
I see, and you can make the argument that by bringing Civ to even the console, right, with Civilization Revolution a few years ago, because consoles have had that surge with the diversity and the interest, then you can certainly make an argument that PC gaming is not as strong as it used to be, and if you use it in terms of, like, dollar figures, we can't argue with that. But even bringing Civilization to Facebook, like, that's a contemporary take on Civilization. Even if we ourselves are not interested in it, and or we're not interested in Civilization Revolution because it's on the console, we can get something. We can all be satisfied to some degree. Maybe you're sacrificing making one particular group completely happy. And some people have drawn kind of a connection to trying to make even strategy games with a more mass appeal, and that you end up with things like Civilization Revolution, which people harp on as a negative thing, or Civilization World, or even some effects that some people are seeing with regards to Civilization V as compared to Civilization IV. But,
you know, you have some good points there. I was just thinking, based on what you're saying, you know, like, why don't they make some competent games for console that are Civ-like, or maybe Civ itself? I mean, a lot of the criticism from Civ Revolution was just people being fuddy-duddies or whatever about the console thing in general. But console GUIs and controls have evolved a lot now, and I don't see any reason you could not have a game that was modeled precisely like Civ 4 or Civ 5 on console and be able to play it at a decent speed. Certainly faster than most people play on PC anyway, because most people are pretty slow at Civ, as far as I'm concerned.
And that's the important thing.
Well, no, but I guess my point is it would not make much difference in playtime. And certainly if you had something like the Wiimote, at that point you almost have computer-like controls, as long as you have a good user interface design. I know that's not really Fraxis' strong suit, given our recent history with both Civ 4 and 5, but even so, if that were done well, you could easily have a controllable turn-based strategy game, and that's part of the reason that they're not mainstream, is that there's no, I mean, Civ Rev aside, I can't think of too many well-known, popular turn-based strategy titles for console, and console's the bigger part of the market, I guess, so what are you going to do with that? You can certainly make a good turn-based strategy for console. They've even done it in the past, back with games like, I don't know, similar models to Final Fantasy Tactics. You could do it. And you could do it well. I don't know if it's up to Firaxis and 2K, but it's something that I think they should have explored with XCOM instead of diving right at a first-person shooter title, which it's hard for me to picture it doing well. I wish them the best of luck if they're going to try it, but I don't know. Don't know.
And this, we touched upon it about the whole Charles and Wes thing, and he says he likes the example of music artists, and so in other words, could we extrapolate then that as saying if Civilization was new today, or perhaps there was the original Civilization, and we didn't have Civ 2, 3, 4, 5, the Call to Power offshoots, anything like that, that if Civ had been left, as XCOM had been for more than a decade, yes, it's intellectual property, but nobody's doing anything, nobody's doing with it, that Civ would be a first-person shooter today?
Yeah, right. What the hell? That would be stupid.
Don't give them ideas, because apparently that's not out of the realm of possibility.
And please, yes, don't give them ideas. I'm already mad enough about XCOM being a first-person shooter. I mean, I realize you do a lot of shooting in it, but come on, it was a tactical game, and not the Rainbow Six kind of tactical either. Not that Rainbow Six is bad.
They better at least do something like that. They better keep some tactical strategy element in it, or, oh my god.
Well, I think, Mr. Hartman, if you were trying to get press for XCOM because you thought perhaps it wouldn't get that much press, just simply because of, in your own views, it only appeals as it exists to fossils, like us, not being gamers, then you have succeeded in generating press. I will give you that. And you may view even negative press as better than no press at all, but certainly there could have been a better way. I mean, just ignore us. I'd rather be ignored, honestly. Sometimes, don't say anything at all. Don't do anything at all. Just, I go my way, you go your way. Maybe that's what we need to do right now. I'm going to move on from you, from Mr. Hartman. And actually, not that I really knew much of anything about you to begin with.
Before we make a fossil out of him.
Oh, Mackie and I will talk later. We'll talk. You know, like even said, like the 90s generation of gamers all love XCOM and we own the IP, so we thought, okay, what do we do with it?
Derp, let's make it a shooter, because that was totally the most popular genre in the 90s.
We love it, so let's totally change it.
That's right.
Derp. Derp sums up that article pretty well. Just derp, 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 the entire thing.
It's kind of like, you know, this thing is not broken, but we need to fix it.
Yep.
Maybe XCOM would have been more popular if you made some titles before this, that is. Just saying.
And let's just point out that they did try making it more shooterish with a couple of things, their spinoffs, and everybody still loves the original better. So, guys, not taking an example from what people before you have tried. I think Ian wants to move on.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Let's open that slide.
Next up, we have a thread by the name, Which Aspects Do You Prefer? This is by SivNoob13, and this is a thread with a poll, which is one of the reasons we've chosen it, I suppose. Actually, I think this is an interesting thread idea. And basically what it is the poster has a list of things that were, are unique in either Civ 4 or Civ 5 that are different between the two games, whatever, how you want to look at it, and asking which ones we prefer. For example, infinite units per tile versus one unit per tile and so forth. So I don't know the best way to approach this. I mean, certainly I have my own opinions on this. And contrary to what some may believe, it is not all Civ 4 favored. For example, I like, as a model, one unit per tile better than the mass stacks. I think Civ 5 could have implemented better. I think it could have used smaller grids or whatever. But certainly as a design concept, I like the one unit per tile better because you have more tactical impact on the game that way. It does put more pressure on the AI. So if I'm an AI, I prefer infinite units per tile, but otherwise one unit per tile. I think that's a lot of its difficulty in Civ 4 comes up, actually. But design-wise, it's just better for strategy overall because it's another layer. And there was some strategy in stacks, yes, but I think overall tactical combat potential is higher with one unit per tile, and therefore I'd prefer that. When it comes to cities, I like Civ 4's model. I just like that somebody trying to defend themselves, they need to do that to stay alive. Like, you have to put some effort into defending yourself to do well. I know you have to do some in Civ 5, but defenses are really strong, so I'm not sold. I think the most recent patch did nerf the cities a bit. Might change my opinion on that after I get the chance to play it. I've not been able to play it much since I switched over to Linux.
I wouldn't mind if the radius that the city could defend itself from was just that ring directly around it or something, as long as it still could. I mean, it gives you that turn or two to get your army, move your army from one side to the other or something. Because even if somebody, no, so I'll bring the realism argument, you'd kind of know that somebody was attacking and it'd give you the chance to move your troops around when they're more mobile.
Civ 4 and Civ 5, the idea is that you put some investment so you don't lose cities that way. You don't just start with that resistance ability.
Well, yeah, your attack's absolute crap at first. So you can barely hit a barbarian.
Yeah, it still roughs up units pretty hard, though. Speakers earned by population or commerce, I think that's a watch. There's some dynamics to both models. Both models can work. Actually, the Civ 4 research is not just earned by commerce, by the way. You can hammer it out directly or work specialists. But same thing with population. It's just you're still deciding whether you're investing infrastructure into your research or, getting it from other sources, be they have trades or research agreements. I really don't have a preference there as long as it's balanced, which tech trades and research agreements both are not. They're too strong relative to other sources of research, so whatever. Civics and social policies, again, I think social policies need some work, but as a design model, you can go either way on that. And so civics had their little quirks, too. Serfdom was terrible, still is terrible, and if you run from a 4000 BC, you'd never run it. Kind of like, let's say, the late-game War 1 in Civ 5.
Autocracy.
Yeah, autocracy is kind of iffy. I mean, unless it's later starch or something. But that's true for serfdom as well. Local health and happiness. You see, I don't like the comp, but I don't like comparing happiness in Civ 4 and Civ 5 because happiness is function in Civ 5 is that of maintenance in Civ 4 rather than the model that Civ 4 used happiness for. I wouldn't mind if Civ 5 added some kind of local layer to the game. But I would compare maintenance and happiness in Civ 4 and 5 and make that a coin flip. I think that's a more fair way to look at it. Interesting thing about religion, Civ 5, I guess, was planning religion. People are saying that they found stuff in the code referencing it, so I think we may see that, but I don't know. I prefer Hex to Squares. It's, quote-unquote, more fair movement, and certainly a lot of good tactical strategy games in the past have used Hexes. It's weird to the Civ series, but that doesn't make it bad, necessarily, and I think that's true for a lot of the stuff Civ 5 did. It's weird to the Civ series, but it doesn't make it bad. It's just there's some preference there, and certainly there's some implementation of some of the design ideas in Civ 5 that hold it back. And then finally, culture. I actually like Civ 5 culture a little better. I'm sorry. Civ 4's culture is kind of wonky and boring. And when a computer Civ or even most human Civs tried to pursue it in a game with other humans, it usually just led to death. So it was like the equivalent of not trying. I like that Civ 5 at least explores something different. Reading through it, I think you have some steps forward with Civ 5 and some regressions when it comes to design choices. But overall, it's just a different game, and it's not as polished yet because it's not as old.
On the happiness versus health, when they were grouped together, in Civ 4, I didn't mind having to manage health, but I hated having the unhealthy faces over my cities if I didn't have enough health. So I'm glad that is gone, you know, that I don't have to see that horrible punishing face over my cities if I don't have enough health.
You needed that, though, because you wouldn't know that you're having your food sucked away otherwise.
But it just looks terrible.
You needed some indication that you are unhappy or unhealthy. Yeah, it could have gone with a...
It ruined my pretty little cute little maps. I didn't like
it. Well, then you just get more healthy. There you go.
I know, or kill them off, but it just... It offended me, so I'm glad that that's gone.
I see. The yuck icons.
Yeah, it was just yucky.
I like the Civ 5 culture better. You know exactly where it's going to spread next. It shows you what tiles it's picking. If you want to get a tile earlier, you can buy it. If you want to grief another human or the AI by snatching away a resource tile, you can do that too.
And you can take blame for it more readily.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally your fault. All this
culture griefing is pretty funny. Yeah, also, you're not going to troll by flipping stuff away. Or if you do, you spent a great person to do it, and then a human would have every right to be mad at you.
intentionally troll. You can't accidentally troll with the culture in this game so much. I mean, in 5.
Whoops. So I completed Sistine Chapel. I have the equivalent of a wonder in every city.
Troll Team Chapel.
I'm going to say that I also prefer the culture in Civ 5, but I could see the quote-unquote fun of the culture flipping, not if you're on that end of it, of course, because then either you've got to try to flip it back or you need to try to go to war. I say try to go to war because you may or may not be successful with it. I think my views on a lot of these things, and it's kind of interesting, just the order that he listed, like we've got 8 different sets of comparisons between Civ 4 and Civ 5. You talk about the units per tile, and then the city defense, and then he put the square and hex tile consideration down farther, and I would have grouped all 3 of those together. I prefer what is in Civilization 5 in all of them. I will admit that when I was looking at the infinite unit per tile versus the 1 unit per tile, I don't know why anybody would say no preference regarding units per tile. That seems to be such like a fundamental consideration, but okay. Part of me was like, I like the thought of 1 unit per tile more than infinite units per tile. It would be nice if you could have more than 1 unit per tile, but not infinite numbers, and then that just becomes a big smorgasbord of ridiculousness. Yes, you could quote me on that. So I guess I will go with the 1 unit per tile. You know, the Civ, you know, Civ 4 cities can't defend but can store multiple units, and Civ 5 cities can defend but store 1 unit. I do very much like the ability with Civ 5 where cities can defend. There's the cities can defend, and also if you don't have a unit in the city, that even if you're not able, even if the city's not able to bombard the unit, say a barbarian down to nothing, that doesn't mean that, oop, you can scoop in and take your city right away. That was, talked about the Civ 4, about how the science is earned, and I think comments here are really reflective in the poll. I mean, that's the discussion in the poll part anyway, that's really neck and neck. I too say no preference regarding science. If you took that away and said you must have a preference regarding science, I'm going to go with Civ 4s, but I can't really put into words why. Maybe it's just because I'm more familiar with it. I've played the game longer. I don't know. I'd go with social policies too. With Civ 5, yes, as a concept, some of the specifics, well, we've discussed some of those specifics before. Even now, it seems like any patch we're talking about with Civ 5, social policies are touched upon in some way. Agree about the comparison between the health and health and the happiness. In choosing, I didn't end up choosing a Civ 4's local health and local happiness. The religion thing, yes, it was in the code initially. People have seen that religion was going to be in there. I prefer Civ 4 because it did have the religious aspect. Again, as a concept, not necessarily as a practice. Hex tiles, absolutely. I was afraid of them.
They're so pretty.
But now I'm a complete convert to that. So good poll. Other than maybe the happiness comparison, which was only really problematic. I also like that for each one of them, you could actually say no preference.
Dan approves of there being a banana option on this poll.
Yes, I do. Anyway, to roll back to pre-patch, talking about Civ 5 specifically.
Well, there basically is. You just have to modify most of the XML back to what it was, which isn't too functional.
What, are we going to see version mods popping up? Probably, if there aren't already.
That wouldn't be too hard to do, and it'd be a pretty good idea. I'm sure some people would like to go back. There are always fans of nostalgia.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion in this thread where a lot of people were saying, yes, you can, no, you can't, yes, you can, no, you can't. And I think that's an important consideration, but I think the deeper question is, should it even happen? And I think that there should be not so much a way to roll back, although I could certainly see that discussion. I'm kind of seeing, I would kind of flip the question on its coin is there a way to stop going post-patch? I understand the consideration of previous Civs is that if you didn't read the forums, for example, or you didn't read news, you didn't visit the official website, the support site, you wouldn't know probably about updates to the game. So therefore, so many people never did get the game updated. Whereas now, it's updating all the time, short of some extraordinary measures. And I've never actually tried myself to not have it update automatically. But it would be nice, as was suggested in this thread, to say there be a dialog box. There is a new patch for... It doesn't just have to be for Civilization V, any Steam game. There is an update for this game that you own. Do you want to apply it? Maybe in that little dialog box you can include a link to the official patch notes. And then after that one notification, if you say no, then maybe you could have somewhere on the screen, it's on the screen, but it's kind of a passive thing. By the way, there's an updated patch version just in case you change your mind later on. There's a nice way to get it. But rather than simply steamrolling it in, I know, for example, for Windows updates, I have mine configured to say, tell me when there are updates, but don't even download them, let alone installing them without asking me. I mean, it's not as severe as like with a Windows update, you want to do something and, oh, currently downloading Service Pack 1. And then, of course, it's like, oh, I guess I can't do what I thought I was going to do right now because my, quote-unquote, my computer has decided that this is what I'm going to do. Give us, as the user, the option whether or not we want to update it. You think it's important? You should bring it to our attention. Well, let me decide.
Was that steamrolling pun intentional?
Yeah, I was going to ask. I wanted to go...
Actually, no, it would have been... I don't know, was it funnier that it wasn't intentional? It would have been funny if it was intentional, but it actually was not.
I think this way works. I do think that was interesting, though. We got it steamrolled on us.
Roll it.
No, don't singing.
That's right, no singing.
We were
just
about to be stopping at a good level there, and then nope, crossed the line. Of course, that's our general approach to things, so it does work.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about the no singing rule. Sure, let's go with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it gets you less
getting
trouble
harder, than harder to cross the line, though.
I was making the singing relevant to the conversation, not just singing for singing.
Has that ever stopped us from stopping you before?
No.
All right, then.
I know that history is a good indicator, but just because you always did something doesn't mean that you should continue doing it. See, I'm trying to get you to think about these things.
Yeah, right.
It's true.
Let's see. Some more of the strong opinions in this thread about either way, about allowing to roll back to the pre-patch. Sataru says that I've always liked the auto-update feature precisely because I can't be bothered to read the forums daily to see if patch is released. People want updates seamlessly for new features and updates. Civ 5 is a bit of an exception where a patch can drastically change the game. Unquote. I don't know if Civ 5 is necessarily an exception. I think any patch could drastically change any game. But anyway, he says, you know, there's nothing crude about this system. And yeah, I think it is crude in the sense that there is a new patch, therefore we will apply it for you, and you can read about it afterwards if you want.
Uh-huh.
And I do like that there is the ability, you can go into news for Steam for a particular game, and you can see, hey, here are the patch notes. Because you may think, oh, there's a patch, oh, it fixed some stability things, that's great. Now I'm going to go in and start playing.
Definitely crude, and you can tell because there's such a long-running standard of patches, updates, changes, things like that, is to get some control over the when and how. You want to play a game, but now you have to wait forever. That's not doing anybody favors.
You can turn it off in Steam. You have to click on the particular game, left-click on it in your list, and then under properties, under updates, it has where you can tell it not to automatically update the game. So you can at least do that. Okay. You may not always know if there's a patch available, but you can keep it from doing that. It's too late for the people who have already gotten this new patch and don't want it, but in the future.
Well, yeah, isn't that actually the feature is it's like either it's there is patches or there's no patches. There's no selective way even.
Yeah.
Give us the choice. Make your case for why we should update the game. And then...
Rollback, no. Stop it from the future, yes.
MIT scientist teaching a computer to play Civ?
Yeah. So they had this computer, and it started up on its own, and it had a win rate of 46%. And then their, you know, quote-unquote groundbreaking work was to teach it to play by reading the manual. So obviously it was a female computer. And its win rate jumped up to 79%. So it got 33% better when it learned how to read the manual. But the paper is actually really interesting, how it broke down the words and learned. And it's all kinds of funky stuff that I don't understand because I'm not a computer programmer. But I thought it was pretty cool. I thought it was also very handy because it can, if they do this to all the computers, it can actually protect us from computers taking over the world because they'll keep doing one more turn and not bother us. It was Civ 2 and not Civ 5, so we don't have to get into whether Civ 5 is good or bad. They can just be happy with Civ 2. But I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and specifically it was free Civ. That's so they could actually get into the code.
So they didn't have to worry about permission in it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, in the abstract, or in kind of the preface on the article on MIT News, it started where an associate professor of computer science and electrical engineering, she developed a system that generated scripts that would install a piece of software on a Windows computer by reviewing instructions posted on Microsoft's help website. And then they said, okay, let's see if we can actually get it to learn to play Civilization. And as Kelly noted, they tried it before it learned by reading the manual, as opposed to not reading the manual. And it was pointed out in some of the Civ community threads, if you tried to do that with Civilization 5 by having it read its manual,
yeah. No.
Manuals aren't what they used to be. That may be putting it mildly.
I've never read a manual for Civ 5 specifically. I've always relied on the forum.
And I think that's probably a notable reason why perhaps manuals aren't what they used to be, or even strategy guides, for that matter. If you've never read a Civilization manual, and actually we're talking about this makes me want to read the manual for the original Civilization again. It was a pretty hefty volume. It was very well a book on its own.
I read the manual, but I was like a 12-year-old. Like, I read it all the time, but I don't remember why. I like that thing. That thing was thick, too, especially the expansion one. Do you guys remember the expansion manual? That thing was crazy. You could spend, like, an hour plus reading that. Probably much more than that, actually. That was awesome, though. I mean, there's no point for it nowadays, but back then it was so fun to read that. That's why I took a little bit of offense at the women-only reading manuals here. I mean, this isn't one of those engineering jobs which tried to read the manual. It's one of those manuals that you could read for enjoyment. It was awesome.
We're such geeks.
Gosh, we're just kind of We're kind of falling into Hartman's description of us as fossils. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
Kids, get off my lawn.
Back then, XCOM was a good series, you know?
It was. Maybe it wasn't the first modern.
I hate to go back to the other topic anyway, but it makes me wonder how old that Christoph Hartman is anyway. But whatever.
Old enough to know better.
I only ever grazed this PDF, but it seems like it actually is playing better than just from adaptive, you know, what leads to wins, losses. It seems like the actual manual is improving it. I wonder if there's a way that future games can use something like this and, like, take into consideration the guide of, like, a top player or something like that during game testing and then model AIs play based on it. I'm wondering if that's something that could be done to make it a little bit more competent. It'd be hard to make an AI perform well in tactical combat situations, but anything could help, right?
There are a couple of questions posed in the MIT News Office thread where one of the authors of this study, S.R.K. Brenovan, answered. The other people involved were Regina Barzilay and David Silver. Glenn Tompkins asked, I'm curious which version of the game, I'm going to address that, and also what difficulty level, and did the program do better playing as or against particular civilizations? The game personalizes different historical civilizations by giving them slightly different capabilities. The response was, this was tested on FreeCiv version 2.2. FreeCiv doesn't have the concept of special traits for different historical civilizations, so we didn't test how such traits would affect the performance of our method. Having said that, our algorithm learns to adapt its gameplay based on what the opponent is doing, so it will learn different strategies against opponents with different strategy tactics. Which is interesting, and that's very good about, you know, like good AI or really any good thinking at all, that if you're playing against somebody else, my understanding that these were all two-player games, in order to improve your performance or to even be consistent with your performance, like you won the last game, but now you're going to play against a different person, maybe your tactics are going to have to be different, or at least the timing is a little bit different. And then Hatterick says, I'm curious as to which victory conditions the AI tended towards. He said that our algorithm is inherently biased towards finding the fastest way to win the game. Against the built-in AI, this happens to be world domination via an early rush strategy. So that is what the method ends up learning.
I knew it.
And I'm like, there's a surprise.
It makes sense. Every Civ game is favored war. Every single one. Or if you win that aspect of the game, you're going to win. So it makes sense that a computer model that is pursuing victories, especially fast victories, is going to go for that. It's hilarious, though. The AI learned to rush.
I am going to unite the world through diplomacy. I am going to be the first to Alpha Centauri. I am going to create magnificent cities with wonderful culture, or I can just let you know.
Well, when you kill somebody now, you can do all those other things, too, because if everyone else is dead, they're not going to get the space before you. You're certainly going to be the most voted for civilization in the world if you're the only civilization in the world, and you'll be owning every single wonder possible if you're the only one who has any cities. So there is that.
If I read the paper properly, it was just like they set it up so the civilization would do whatever random action, and they would run it out like 20 turns of doing a series of random actions. Like they'd go 20 turns deep and then check the final score. And choose the path that led to the highest final score. It seems to me that the only possible way to win with random actions is domination, so it makes sense that that's the path it chose.
Well, if you're going for a high final score, certainly, because of the early win bias. But I can see that if you left it only to pursue space or other things, even the random actions there could lead to a faster win. Same thing with culture. I don't think you could mod a Deplo that way very well. Well, certainly not in one-on-one. It'd be impossible, but even in larger maps.
Thorne had a comment in the, in the thread on CFC that that computer will never be productive again.
It's true.
Ooh, it's stereo. I think that was even stereo with the ladies.
Synchronized and everything.
Ooh, ladies in stereo and synchronized, and we're going to leave it at that. So now that it's taught itself Pre-Civ 2, first off, they said the main purpose of the project, which was supported by the National Science Foundation in the U.S., was to demonstrate that computer systems that learn the meanings of words through exploratory interaction with their environments are a promising subject for future research. And indeed, Barzilay and her students have begun to adapt their meaning-inferring algorithms to work with robotic systems. No, you should be trying this with other games now, actually.
There's opportunity that game designers who actually don't think that certain games are obvious to make use of in the future. Yeah, I mean, the people in the research that really modeling that, they're not designers, although they should be.
Tech spreading from Genji Khan. I've been thinking in a way to balance scientific research in this game, because we all know that big empires have been better in science research than small empires, but in real world, this isn't true. Just compare Japan or South Korea to countries like Russia or India. One solution to this problem is called tech spreading. Here's how it works. When you research a technology, it will demand some time to this tech for it to spread to all of your cities. Capital will always receive the technology first. The next city can only receive the technology if this city is connected with the capital. The next city with the highest amount of science output will receive the tech some turns after the capital. He kind of elaborated on this a little bit with some edits. For example, that new founded cities will get the same tech spreading of the nearest city. Cities can only contribute with science after they receive all the technologies that the capital currently had, and that the time a tech needs to spread to all of your cities depends on the following factors, just in general. I won't go into the specifics now or yet. Distance, population, happiness, the way that the city is connected with the capital, as well as scientific focus and some particular city improvements being built. It's an interesting concept, and one of the things that came out was in terms of how exactly the technologies would end up spreading. There was what I would call, they didn't use these terms, but there was like a concurrent and a consecutive. If we take it that the capital always receives the technology first, let's just say, even for the sake of argument, it's always coming from your capital. I think you could make the argument that perhaps it should come from whatever city is your particular science leader, which probably is your capital in most cases. But anyway, once you research a technology, it goes from the capital. You could either have it so that it then must go to the next city with the highest technology or all those factors, so then it goes to whatever that city B is, and then it goes to city C, D, E, etc. Whereas the other suggestion was, it's as opposed to being consecutive, it's concurrent. So it will start spreading to B, city B and city C at the same time, but because city B is closer, for example, it's going to get that technology before City C. So therefore, if that technology, say, is ironworking in Civilization V, then the capital right away can start building those swordsmen, whereas City B and C are still going to be building those warriors until ironworking makes it to them. I like it.
Yeah, it's a strange idea, but it has potential.
It's worth testing, and I think that sometimes it's like, you know, this is an interesting concept on paper, and I will admit, he kind of half lost me in the preface where he started talking about the real world. I thought, oh.
Well, yeah, the city, the capital cities would have the technology first, they'd be using it first, and it would take a while to spread out to some back and far-flung outpost before they would get it. It makes sense.
I would link, in addition to this model, that you can spread the technology faster or deliberately with investment into doing so. Or maybe you have it spread faster with investment into doing so, modeling a civilization that's putting additional effort into its research. It would, obviously, a white empire would still have an advantage because it has the production, it has more raw research potential than the smaller empires, but this would be an interesting way to keep runaway civilizations from being too scaled of an advantage. I'd like it as an idea. It would take some tweaking to balance it, certainly, but within the model of Civ 5 or even Civ 4 dumping tech trades, I would like it in either, really. It's an interesting idea.
We added a little more, I think, in Civilization 4 than in Civilization 5 in the sense that, let's say your capital, just using the capital again, You discover iron working. Okay, you have a source of iron in your capital. Okay, you now need to hook that iron up, first off, by building a road on that tile, and then either a road to the capital, or then maybe it could go, you know, get the connection by a river. But then for the other cities, in order to also now to be able to build these swordsmen, they now need to be connected by a road, too. Whereas now in Civilization V, if you have iron, as soon as that is mined, boom, you have it. So I think Civ 4 was a little bit more like this, but at the same time, this concept is extending it beyond just the military unit building considerations, but also getting into city improvements, wonders of the world, and heck, it could even get to, you know, the ability to build certain tile improvements as well, because that can come with particular tech.
Pretty sure the only reason Civ 5 pulled that requirement was road maintenance, so it's the only one that makes sense to me why you would do that.
The tooltips, like, still have some pop-up about, like, if you hover over a luxury, it says, connect this with a road. So I think originally they planned to do that.
I don't know. But I do think road maintenance does have a big impact on how people use roads in Civ 5.
These talks about, you know, we talk about distance, population, more specifically in terms of what Genji Khan is saying, that tall cities are also likely to receive techs faster than smaller cities. Happiness. Tech spreading will demand 30% more time if your empire is unhappy, but a very happy empire, which he's defined as plus 15 happiness, more than plus 15 happiness, so I guess it has to be plus 16 or over, will have a bonus in tech spreading of 25%. Try not to get caught up in particular percentages that he has described here. But, you know, there's unhappy, and then there's also unhappy. I guess I think of, so that's like one unhappy face, or is that like the 10 unhappiness face threshold we have right now, where you get a reduction in growth and military strength and production?
I'd rather not link it to that particular global mechanic and make it even more important than it is. Because happiness is already serving a maintenance function. I'd rather see some kind of infrastructure investment in a city causing it to receive the technologies faster. And that might be a little counterintuitive, though. Like, you would want, like, a library and a university in your hammer city for units or something. But even so, it would make more sense, and it would kind of balance better than just tying it all into happiness again.
I'm not sure what impact the tech spreading would have on the game, if any, overall. Mainly due to unit upgrading, so even if your tech hasn't, even if ironworking hasn't spread, you can still build warriors in your other cities and then upgrade them to swordsmen.
It's true.
And then the speed at which you would be able to do so. But I guess, I think the impact is coming more from the timeliness factor and the fact that it extends beyond just the units themselves and the upgrade abilities. Like, as an example, walls, for example. What tech do we need for that?
Construction, maybe?
So let's say that you've got a border city and someone's breathing down your neck and getting all up in your grill, and you're realizing, oh, I really haven't done very well in terms of what I thought I should have had in terms of a military presence there. I know this is a very specific consideration, but you at least have the perception that if you have walls, it will be able to buy you that extra turn or two to get those units in position, or maybe even getting enough gold to go boom, insta-build in your city. You want to be able to build the walls, but you haven't spent the time to ensure that your city is connected to your empire by a road, or the article also talks about that harbors would act as the same method, and I assume even maybe you could even extend that to rivers like Civ 4 or whatever. But then you realize, oh no, I'm not going to be able to build the wall in time because I haven't spent the time in order to hook the cities together. And yes, the advantage to hooking the cities together by road, as I expect that would be the most common means, was that you would then establish that trade route between the cities. Phil also mentioned the maintenance issue that it comes with regards to the road. So if you were to implement this, you may need to look at, in terms of the cost of road maintenance, or exactly how you determine what roads were of particular maintenance. Like, perhaps you could say, if you happen to build a road that's outside of your culture, and I'm just throwing this out there, that's going to cost more, or that's going to be the road that costs maintenance as opposed to a road that's within your culture of borders. As now we're starting to get into, okay, we implement this particular change, what's the ripple effect?
There's some other ripple effects. You, like, say you tech education and you want to quickly get universities everywhere and get Oxford or you desperately need happiness, so you just picked up happiness technology, and now you want to start building these happiness buildings, and a lot of your cities can't do it. I think, as pointed out, the units can just be upgraded, and I don't know, unless you had some sort of model where unless you're half your cities have the tech, you can't upgrade or something weird like that, which might be needed for balance. It's so hard to make balance guesses without even having played under these settings. But unless you had something like that that barred upgrades, this would have a bigger impact on buildings, for what I can see. Because if those, you know, you wouldn't be able to build them, and you might want them quickly, and you might want the payoff from reaching the technology, which is, in some cases, the buildings you can construct as soon as possible. And with a larger empire, you wouldn't be able to, like, get it, it'll slow you down. So it is worth consideration under these rules.
In the chat, Ben knows that maybe Stiff should require cheaper to maintain paths in order to connect to exploit land resources. Imagine says, but the cost of the trade route roads mean you have to lose even more. maybe perhaps as a means towards that maintenance or getting the road set up, that if you're able to get yourself access to a particular resource, maybe even a resource that you know about already on the map, but you can't get to, like any of the masonry techs, for example, in order to be able to build a quarry, maybe that would make it so that your road network is either quicker to build or less to maintain or something, if we want to keep that unit maintenance. But beyond that, quote-unquote, initial unit maintenance path, as it kind of almost seems like to me, we're probably going to want to have to change that dynamic very shortly after we try to implement the system. But the other impacts as well. He also talks about that technologies can spread to coastal cities where you build a lighthouse. And he's got spreader cities. Okay, and harbors have similar effects to roads. Talks about that if you get railroads then increase the technology spreading by 30%. In particular, buildings, stables, markets, seaports, universities, research lab, and broadcast tower increase tech spreading if you build them in cities that receive technologies and in the cities that spread technology. So there could be an advantage there then, impartial to say, well, I want this city to get that particular technology. It doesn't need this particular building in order to get that technology, but I want it to be able to get there faster because I want to be able to put that building in there. I want to be able to build this more modern unit, or kind of what you were saying there, Paul, to be able to upgrade the unit that's stationed in there, say to go from the warrior to swordsman or swordsman to long swordsman or whatever it happens to be. Built on it quite a bit, I think, from what was the initial post, and he's documented in his opening post where he's edited things based on feedback that he's received in the thread, like certain technologies as well, like machinery and combustion increase the tech spreading on road connections, navigation and steam power increase tech spreading and harbor connections, telegraph eliminating the distance factor of tech spreading.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. I hesitate to advocate for its immediate inclusion, just because I'd like to see the game's user interface, see a little bit of help that it badly needed since before it was released, and multiplayer address things like that. But I like it as an idea, and I think it could make Civ 5 more dynamic, potentially.
Maybe when they release Beta 6, they'll include it.
There you go.
So perhaps a starting base for this, and this is, I was about to say, so much to work on modding this in, but it's that's like the tip of the iceberg, but still that may be a source to start, either not Genji Con you specifically, but if you want to take this even further beyond the discussion phase and actually look at testing it, have a look at the modding communities on CFC and other places online, the 2K forums. Then maybe you can get a group of people together to start testing it and see can you make this practical? Can this be implemented practically? And can this be fun? I think it can.
Yeah, me too. There's precedent for mods being used in the general game, so if it's good enough, see it.
Does playing a Civ with a butt ugly color bother you? For me, it totally does. My very first appearance on the show, I was kind of sort of made fun of because when I was talking about Gandhi, I made just a comment about how he has a pretty color and a lot of people on the forums for that being important to me, but it is. And in a lot of the other versions of Civ, I would go into the text files and change the colors of people if I wanted to play them and I didn't like their color. But if there's a way to do that in Civ 5, I haven't figured it out yet.
Oh, man.
There are some color schemes I don't like, but it really, not really, it does not impact whether or not I'm going to play them. At least not consciously. I don't think, oh, I don't like this color, so therefore I'm not going to play them. Or I really like their color, and therefore I am going to play them. I can't find myself in the same depth of this topic that you are, Kelly, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I won't not play somebody because of their color, but I would go to the extent of altering the files in the past to get a color I liked better.
Yes, I'm not entirely enthralled with Gandhi's new color scheme, but I still play him.
Yeah, but he had a really pretty color scheme in 4.
Yeah, now it's
He got demoted in the color department, I'm sorry.
Yes.
5 was bad in that manner.
England has a better
color. I used to troll people so bad in Civ 4. When I was still like a constant host of Nobles Club games and Metamortal University games, one of my favorite things to do is when people insisted on different speeds, different difficulties or whatever, in my XML file for the World Builder save, I would deliberately give them asinine colors. a lot of black would show up. If you played as World from the World Builder save, you would get a black Civ, or you would get... I favored the Malanese brown a lot to annoy people. Or I would give them Germany's gray and then put them near a similar color to a civilization that's near them.
Yeah, the gray by white and stuff.
Zulu. Yeah, or like Zulu in Egypt. So if there's Egypt nearby, I would make somebody the color of the Zulu.
Nice.
Bit of a field day. I use white a lot, too.
So, Kelly, Bam Bam wants to know if you're an interior designer.
No, I'm actually an environmental engineer. That's why the faces bothered me so much, the ugly faces.
Oh, okay.
My environment is not proper.
I will say that at times where you have civilizations that are similar colors, and if they are together, and, you know, like, it can at times look like one continuous blob, and I think that could help. Like a border edge, if that was like a distinct color, like if that was white or black or something.
You mean like in Civ 4 where we've got Portugal, Ethiopia, and somebody else who all have a very similar shade of green?
Mm.
Yes.
I've experimented with the game engine, though, and you can give people identical colors, and when their borders touch, you can still see the edges of the borders up against each other. And at least for me, as long as I'm not looking at a mini-map, that's pretty clear. Although, it is kind of annoying to look on a mini-map and see, like, all one Civ when it's really two.
I guess that's just the fossil in me. My eyes are going, okay.
Oh, Ken's eyes are worse than mine. How is that possible?
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
And with that, you may need to look for a shoulder to cry on because we have come to the end of another Polycast. No!
Aww.
This has been Polycast episode 125 with the VN team.
Be sure to join me next week for first-person shooter-only mode.
Nice. Hey, Matt Candy.
Bye.
Makalua.
Yeah, you join me next week for classic turn-based tactical mode.
Me, Vaccine, and our host, Dan Q.
Grant me the serenity to accept that some people speak before they think, courage to think before I speak, and wisdom to know that there are those who will never realize the difference.
That was good. I like that one.
Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Ready for
it? What?
Let's go.
Just got out.
Take whatever number we're up to now.
I think 125.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Hello, and welcome to episode 125. Stop it! Okay, this is...
Hi, I'm Maggie, and I'll be derailing your topics for you today.
You'd be that much farther ahead as if you hadn't tried it, so have a look. Which is kind of funny for me to say, have a look on an audio-only show, but you know what.
Have a listen.
Record date, July 23rd, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.